Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Have you heard Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR? Give us 10 minutes or so, and you can get a sense of the stories and big ideas of the day. Wake up with Up First tomorrow morning by 6 a.m. on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll check in with the Hulu adaptation of The Handmaid's Tale, and we'll see what's up with the new NBC comedy, Great News. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And we have two so-called fourth chairs. So we have a third chair and a fourth chair. In our third chair, while Stephen Thompson takes the week off, is our friend Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Barry is an editor on Weekend Edition. Is that still correct, ma'am?
That is still correct. Am I sitting in his very chair?
Well, no. You're sitting in Glenn's chair and Glenn's in Steve. The whole thing is very complicated.
Uh-huh. I just wanted to wiggle.
I know, right? And in our actual fourth chair this week, we are so excited. It is always an extra special week whenever we have someone new to the Pop Culture Happy Hour family. And with us this week in our actual fourth chair is Leah Donnella of our Code Switch team. Hi, Leah.
Hello.
Leah is with us to talk about two topics this week. It might sound flip to say Margaret Atwood was writing dystopian fiction before its current wave of popularity, or as we might say, before it was cool, but it's true. And before we talk about The Handmaid's Tale, we should caution you. The specific dystopia here is particular, and it involves sexual violence and sexual slavery. The TV adaptation we're going to be talking about is quite intense, and the discussion will be too, and we want to make sure that you know that going in. Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, is the story of a society located in what once was New England and is now a place where a crisis of fertility has led to the sexual slavery of a class of women known as handmaids, who are raped by the men in the households where they live and forced to bear children who are then taken from them. The adaptation currently streaming on Hulu was created by Bruce Miller, who's an experienced hand in both science fiction shows and more conventional dramas. It stars Elizabeth Moss as a woman named June, who is renamed Offred after she is captured, as well as Joseph Fiennes, Yvonne Strahovski, Alexis Bledel, and Samira Wiley. Barry, when did you first read The Handmaid's Tale?
I read it in college, in my women's studies class.
Sure.
Which is a place that I think many people encounter it. But I just reread it, actually, mm-hmm. in order to prepare for the series. Mm-hmm. Leah and I, in fact, talked about it on our show. Having just reread the book, the places that the series diverges are very interesting. And also, you know what I was reminded, and I want to say before we say anything more, is that the book is a rollicking good read. It is a fantastic piece of fiction that you really will read in one sitting.
Yeah.
It's maybe one of her most tightly constructed novels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love Blind Assassin. I love Robber Bridegroom, all that stuff. This may be one of her, just structurally, the best of the bunch.
Yeah.
So don't ignore the book in favor of this marvelous series.
It's been interesting to me because she is a really interesting kind of personality. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden in reality, all of a sudden again, kind of. And for a while, she's been like on Twitter. Mm-hmm. She kind of goes back and forth with like, isn't it Rob Delaney? Mm-hmm. She has like a friendship with Rob Delaney on Twitter.
She's a woman who has like, not surprisingly, has really been with the times at all times. You know, she is sort of sailing along in the same seas that we all are, which is probably one of the reasons that she was able to see what she was able to see when she first wrote this book.
Leo, when did you first encounter The Handmaid's Tale?
So I first read it about 2 years ago, just because I was like hating a lot of men in my life and wanted to read something.
Yeah, I hear you.
But then I also reread it a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. It was originally set close to that 1985 publication date. Did it feel dated to you when you read it?
It didn't really. It felt very, very present.
Yeah. How do you feel about the TV adaptation?
I really like the show. To me, it's a lot harder to watch than it was to read the book.
Interesting.
I think just something about like seeing people actually experiencing what you read about is like much more difficult than it was to read.
Yeah. I think when you put visualization to certain things, for example, the way that these women are essentially forcibly impregnated is through this what they call a ceremony, but it's just a ritualized rape that takes place in front of another woman who's the wife of whoever the man is who kind of runs the household. And I do think there's an argument that those things are much more viscerally upsetting to watch mm-hmm. than they are to read about.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Glenn, what is your experience with The Handmaid's Tale?
Let's finally, a man can weigh in. Thanks, God.
Yes, exactly. He's waiting to hear this.
He's kidding.
I have a complicated history with this book because I read it in 1985. I'm reasonably certain
You were a child.
I was in high school. I was a lifelong member of the science fiction book club, Contain Your Shock, and I'm pretty sure this was one of those books. And I grew up getting two science fiction books a month of varying quality, and a lot of them were dystopian, sort of finger-wagging, cautionary tales mm-hmm. in which the characters weren't characters but mouthpieces about mm-hmm. what's coming. And when I read this book back in 1985, I just instinctively sort of put it in that same category. That says more about me, how callow I was, than about the book itself, because right. I had just put it in this box mm-hmm. of didactic heavy-handedness. And then I saw the 1990 film, which is not particularly successful.
Oh, my God, so bad.
Yeah, and that kind of reinforced it. But I haven't revisited the book. What I think this show does so well is it attacks something, it concerns itself with something that in the book, in my memory, was dealt with in exposition. It just asserted an exposition, which is how we get from here mm-hmm. to that world.
Right.
It is doubling down on the connection, how close we are to this world. That's what the show really lives in for me.
Yeah.
It's not about the hierarchy of the world. It's about how close this world is to us,
yeah.
which is why I think the strength of this show, for me at least, is things that usually sap all energy from a project like this, which are the voiceover mm-hmm. and the flashbacks.
Yeah. I agree.
The
really
voiceover
well handled.
Is a rare source of humor, and it is very contemporary feeling. There was absolutely no voiceover in the 1990 film, so she felt even more passive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the flashbacks are so, it's so important that we have a character like Moira, played by Samira Wiley, who is a person who is questioning everything.
Yeah.
So it's not just, here we are, then this happened, which mm-hmm. is kind of how I felt the book was, mm-hmm. which is like, well, here's used to be mm-hmm. this happened, then this happened, then this
yeah.
happened. We feel this push and pull, mm-hmm. and I think that brings this whole thing more alive. It makes it even more harrowing.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously, look, it's not a secret that a lot of the commentary around the TV show has been around the fact that we continue to have very intense debates about abortion and about contraception and about all kinds of things that relate to women's bodies and fertility and sexuality. But one of the things that I like about the show is that I think it is about those things, but it's also about broader things mm-hmm. that have to do with the closeness of kind of viciousness and how easily it comes out of people, and how I think when Glenn talks about the flashbacks, when you see the flashbacks and you see that Elizabeth Moss in the flashbacks looks just like a woman that you would run into
yeah.
now, it makes those handmade costumes, it prevents you from thinking of it as a period piece,
right.
which
mm-hmm.
it isn't,
exactly.
because the costumes remind you so much of kind of puritanical, pilgrimish kind of wear that you could easily think of it as a period piece, and it's not a period piece.
And it's also a way, I think, Margaret Atwood does this very well in the book, the reminders of things that in 1985 were things that you could encounter, like having your credit card cut off.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, when the credit card is cut off, she's in a coffee shop that looks like my coffee shop.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that is kind of a really wonderful thing. And I also will say, just as a piece of entertainment and a piece of visual entertainment, it's gorgeous.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And a particular kind of jab, the violence, which is very present and very graphic, is also really just beautifully shown.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some ways, because there's so little to look at when they're in the current awful place,
mm-hmm.
they don't have a lot of things. They live in these like kind of empty rooms with just very few things are allowed in this society. So everything is particularly, I think, interesting to look at.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. And one of the things Barry made mention earlier of the things that are different as between the book and the series, and
everybody loves the person that does that.
Yeah.
I'm always the most popular at a party.
But in this case, that has been one of the real focal points for a lot of the conversation. Specifically, the treatment of race is mm-hmm. completely different in the book and in the show. Because in the book, I will come out as the person who didn't read the book. Will now, probably, but...
I won't give it away.
My understanding...
It's hard on the ladies.
My understanding of the book's treatment of race is that black people have been essentially removed from the society
and banished. Well, no. It's actually unclear. In fact, Leah very smartly pointed this out when we were talking about it, that, yes, many people have been sent, quote... back to Africa, and
okay.
the Jews have been sent back to Israel.
Right, so to speak.
So to speak, right. Huge so to speaks in there.
Right.
But also that maybe this class of women called the Marthas.
So in the book, Alfred is talking, she describes the women that she comes across, and most of the women she comes across, she'll say, are like pink or beige, but she describes the servants, the Marthas, as having brown skin.
Oh, interesting.
And the way they talk is slightly... Like, I don't want to say it's a dialect, but, like, it's slightly, it feels more like black vernacular than mm-hmm. other uh-huh. characters.
Yeah.
And I have to say, and Leah, now that we've had a chance to watch this more, I think while the show has gotten a lot of praise, as it should, for, A, casting the marvelous Samara Wiley, who owns every scene, as we get further down the pike, I'm finding the treatment of race really problematic because there's this assumption that 2017 or wherever this is this post-racial society, mm-hmm. which doesn't fit with everything that we know about this kind of viciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because, I mean, the story, the whole, like, premise of this story is that it's kind of about creating race, right? So it doesn't make sense to me that they never mention people's race at all.
Yeah.
To me, there were kind of two types of race in this show. There's the race that's like lowercase r race, I guess you could mm-hmm. say, where you have people who are clearly from different backgrounds, mm-hmm. and that is never talked about, which is weird because mm-hmm. they talk about sexuality, they talk about socioeconomic status, but no one ever says anything about race. But I don't think it's an accident or a coincidence that Moira, who's black queer woman on the show, is the one who at every turn is kind of saying, like, these things are unacceptable
yeah.
before mm-hmm. the society changes. She's mm-hmm. the one that,
that's
like,
a really good point.
Kind of calls it out. And I think also, so there's this scene where she's in the, like, training center with everyone else, and she's in a bathroom stall, and she writes on the stall, she, like, scratches into the wall, Aunt Lydia sucks. Mm-hmm. June, who's her best friend, is like, why are you doing that? That's so stupid. You could get in trouble. And she's like, no, I'm doing this because someone else will see it and know that she's not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really important moment of just someone being aware, like, this has happened before and we know we have to leave signs to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And having that kind of consciousness. I guess the bigger race issue is, like, this whole culture is saying we're going to divide people up based on their physical characteristics and their, like, God-given traits and create races of people. Like, that's what the handmaids are, a race, the ants are a race.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a show about race, mm-hmm. but they don't really
address that part. Although there is an opportunity, right, to show the experience of, say, a black handmaid,
mm-hmm.
because you have to imagine there's an opportunity that was not in the book where,
right.
you know, there's a mixed race baby because the handmaid is black.
Right.
Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have to imagine that there is an opportunity here, and I dearly hope they take it.
Bruce Miller, who created the show, has talked about this, and he basically said that they decided that this would be a society where fertility trumps everything else. And I do think he's trying to emphasize those themes about the commodification of fertility, which, frankly, to find someone saying fertility is the basic biological function of women in particular, you can read that in the op-ed sections of major newspapers several times a year.
Mm-hmm. True story.
At that level. But I think what he was kind of saying was, you know, we were trying to do so much that we didn't feel that we could do justice to kind of issues of race. And the problem with that is that what you wind up implying is that somehow as the pressure mm-hmm. mounted and this society became more oppressive, everyone kind of put aside racism mm-hmm. to kind of work together
It's what they said about Mad Men. Do you remember?
Yeah.
I mean, that was what I was really, when I heard him say that, I thought, oh, this conversation has been had with Matthew Weiner.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was unsatisfied with it then.
Yeah.
And that's not to say he hasn't done some really interesting things with the series, but that does feel like that's sort of maybe the problem with, you know, the white male showrunner.
Yeah, and the trick to it.
Sorry, Gilead.
Well, the trick to it to me is it is such an interesting social commentary and social satire, you can't say nothing about race. Do you know what I mean? You can't make a show that says nothing.
Because then it says something.
Well, exactly. By saying nothing or by treating it as a non-issue, they imply that somehow this society, which accepts that Moira at one point, who disguises herself as an aunt, that would be fine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's so weird because they're in this place where everyone is so, like, desperate for any little ounce of power they can get.
Why wouldn't that be?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how could you... They're not just going to give up, like, racial power.
Yeah.
Right. I also, you know, it reminds me back to the place that I read this book in my women's studies course, which where, you know, we were all told to go around the room and say what our definition of feminism was. And I was like, I swear, equality for women. I think I made actually, that was before my voice changed.
Right.
But I remember it being very struck when it said, no, it's about justice. It's about a struggle for justice writ large. Mm-hmm. So this idea that like we're only going to talk about a struggle for justice in terms of women, like this is the whole thing that all the waves of feminism have run into.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, I asked Margaret Atwood I totally just dropped that name, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was at a panel that she was on with Elizabeth Moss, dropped that too. And I said, if you were to go back, if you were to write this book now, would you have, you know, given here we are in 2017 and the conversations around race, would you have stratified that in a different way? Would you have addressed it? And she really said, well, it's there in the book. She was, as she is known to be, super prickly. She said, well, it's there. And, you know, one of the things about the series is you can't, in 2017, we are almost post-racial. And I thought, oh, that's where you end up with blinders on. So, you know.
Interesting.
It was an interesting exchange.
Can we talk about Elizabeth Moss' performance?
Yes.
So much is being done with her face and the combination of just her facial expressions and the voiceover. But here's the thing. This character does not have a poker face. This character conveys so much, and she stares at her quote-unquote masters in a way that is a direct affront, and yet it's part of it. Now, in the 1990 film, that was also in the mix, but you didn't get anything from her because we didn't hear her. Now we can hear her. And again, there's a great moment at the end of the second episode where a little surprise there, and she gives a reaction, which that is a source of humor and relatability, just the way that they're using music here, which is, by the way, not subtle. But we get a lot of contemporary and we get a lot of popular music to show us how close we are to this world.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting is that so much of the story is about tight control of, obviously, women's bodies and all of that. But I think if you look at this series, it's an interesting choice by Atwood, I think, and also by the people behind the show, that if this society fears anything as much as it fears, you know, women having kind of bodily autonomy, the society in the book, it fears their anger. There is such a clamping down on people appearing angry. And I think you can see that not only because Offred, Elizabeth Moss's character, is never allowed to appear angry, but even the other women are only allowed to appear angry to women they outrank. So Yvonne Strahovski, playing the sort of mistress of the house, is allowed to be angry at Offred. And Anne Dowd, who is so wonderful, playing this terrifying, awful, one of sort of the trainers of the handmaids.
Ants.
Is allowed to show anger to them. There are a couple of different times when the handmaids, either in a group or individually, are allowed to release anger. And it's such an interesting metaphor to me for how a society that oppresses people encourages them to then express their anger by finding somebody who is a permitted outlet for it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's safe to say they could have made, I mean, this is, what, a 10-part series, I believe.
And then it's picked up for season two.
Yeah. So this is going to go on. My guess is you could explore a potential dystopian, misogynist, racist, anti-Semitic. They're very brutal to lesbians, who they call gender traitors.
Right. Which they actually, very well handled.
There is a horrifying story about that. If you're staying away from it because it seems too brutal to you, I cannot tell a lie. It's super brutal.
Yeah.
But if you dish it out to yourself an episode at a time, it might be a little bit easier to take.
I don't find it so desolate that it doesn't still feel like entertaining. entertainment to a certain, that I'm, it's making me feel something that I can then still get up from the couch.
Yeah.
You know?
It still feels like art to me and mm-hmm. not just torment.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah.
Come and find us on Facebook and tell us what you think of The Handmaid's Tale if you saw it. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, we are going to take a very hard turn. We are going to go from dystopia to broadcast comedy. We're going to talk about Great News, which is a new show on NBC. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Latote, a fashion subscription box that sends brand name clothing and accessories right to your door for one low monthly fee. Get unlimited totes each month. Simply wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and repeat. Items you love can be purchased for a discounted price. To get started, go to latote.com. That's LETOTE.com. Enter promo code HAPPYHOUR at checkout to get 50% off your first month.
Hi, this is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. This month marks Fresh Air's 30th anniversary as a daily NPR interview program. That means our show is older than two of the people who work on it. So, how are we celebrating? By doing more shows. You can find our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In our first segment, we talked about The Handmaid's Tale. I freely admit this is one of our hardest turns in the history of this show between the A topic and the B topic into every life of dystopia. A little broadcast comedy must fall. In this case, Great News, an NBC show created by Tracy Wigfield and executive produced by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who also brought you 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. There's a lot of 30 Rock in this show, actually, which features Briga Helin as a young news producer whose mother, played by Andrea Martin, arrives at her workplace as an intern. The cast also includes Adam Campbell, Horatio Sanz, John Michael Higgins, and a surprising comedic turn from, and we will get back to this, Nicole Richie. All right. So first of all, I just want to say Mom Comes as an Intern is a really sitcom premise.
It is.
No,
it would only yes, work with Andrea Martin.
Yeah, check me on this, Glenn.
No, absolutely. It's big.
Old, big, broad comedy premise with great broad Andrea Martin.
Uh-huh. This show is a very likable show filled with very likable actors that I'm probably not going to keep watching.
Yeah.
Not because of anything about the show, well, something about the show, but just because there's a lot of TV out there, okay?
Yeah, there
there's
is.
Lots of
prioritize people.
Yeah. This has the Tina Fey, Robert Carlock vibe to it that both 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt have. Those shows have a specific tone, and they don't vary in tone. They vary in bigness. So from mm-hmm. line to line, from scene to scene, the jokes could be a sharp good joke, and then you get a big good joke.
Yeah.
And you usually shunt those off to like Tracy Morgan, Titus Burgess, and Jane Krakowski on
yeah.
both shows. Jane Krakowski is doing that heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And there's an element of manic absurdity that kind of brushes up against surreality. Mm-hmm. Andrea Martin is a goddess, and in her book, Lady Parts, she says, I'll go as big as I need to go for the laugh. Unless the director pulls me back, I'm going to lunge at that mm-hmm. joke. John Michael Higgins is great. Nicole Richie, somebody update me. Because the last time I checked, Nicole Richie was she just stood around with a purse dog looking vacant.
What happened? I'm so glad that's actually my beat.
Yeah, it's
What happened to Nicole Richie is the name of my next book.
Update me, Barry.
So since The Simple Life, which mm-hmm. is where you were trying to,
yeah.
which I watched religiously, she became a jewelry designer. House of Harlow, you may know, very good, sort of 70s type stuff. She married a good Charlotte.
Yeah.
A good charlatan.
One of them. The other one is married to Cameron Diaz. I'm a journalist, people. I pay really, really a lot of attention.
Yep.
But she
yep.
also did actually have this show that was not so far away from this in that it was both, it was called Candidly Nicole, and it was both fictional, but it was all made like a reality show.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very silly in the same ballpark. She exhibited a tiny little bit of a silliness
mm-hmm.
and a kind of kook quality that I have always thought I might be able to admire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Leah, tell me about your Nicole Richie thoughts.
Yeah. So I love Nicole Richie and I loved her on The Simple Life. I think it was her being next to Paris Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
Paris Hilton took that show like so, so seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it didn't seem like she was like acting at all in it. She was just being herself. But Nicole Richie, you could kind of tell was
she
like,
was being a character.
Yeah. She was like playing with it. And sometimes she would say things that were just so goofy, as you said. There was one episode where she's like forced to work in a bakery But there's this like black and white cookie, and she holds it up and she's like, it's black and white like me. And I remember watching that and being like, oh my gosh, I'm like Nicole Richie. Like, I could be on this show. I have a black and white cookie. Awesome.
That's adorable. That is so cute.
Here's the takeaway for the show for me anyway. It exists in this tonal universe of Tina Fey and Robert Carlock. And when I'm in that universe and the jokes are coming like this, I'm in. On this show, the jokes come like this, and that's all it takes for me to be like, I like it. I like what you're doing. It's not quite enough for me. I did skip ahead to the very final episode, tend to see if it all came together and things went out like this. And no, it's still good, still fine. And there is a marvelous piece of casting, which I will not spoil, that if that character stays in the show, I might reconsider because he or she is great. Yeah. But yeah, it's I need a little faster.
Yeah, you need a little more density in a show like this. What'd you think, Leah, generally, what'd you think of the show?
I mean, generally, I thought it was kind of boring, but there, I think because it like moved a little bit slower, there were these specific moments that I was actually like hysterically laughing. It's fine. Like, it's a fine show to watch.
You know, this is the kind of show, it occurred to me when I was watching it, this is the kind of show that used to get Emmy nominations.
That's interesting.
For like Andrea Martin. I mean, if you had put this show out in 1992, which you could have, you know, you would have a really decent shot at an Andrea Martin Emmy nomination because she's great, because there was so much less television, and because if you had a great, reliable actress like Andrea Martin, you had a decent shot at Emmy nominations. It's, to me, it hits that spot of like, I think it's not great the way that 30 Rock was great for the same reason that you're talking about. I think in a lot of ways it maps sort of for me onto 30 Rock a little bit. Where if the central character is your Liz Lemon, then in a way her mother is your Tracy Jordan, who's the outside force who comes into the workplace and throws everything into chaos. The Nicole Richie character is sort of the Jenna, who's kind of self-absorbed and says absurd things about celebrity culture and the lengths to which she will go. Your Jack Donaghy is a little bit your John Michael Higgins anchor, playing, it must be said, the John Michael Higgins role. And if you've seen him in, you know, any of the Christopher Guest stuff that he's done, he's wonderful. He's so funny. And I love him and I love watching him. I agree with Glenn that the jokes aren't quite fast enough, but I like this style. And there's something about old-fashioned sitcoms that sometimes hits a certain not that challenging spot in my brain. What do you think, Barry?
It's possible that I liked it better than any of you guys. Which is I wonder if that's because I work in a newsroom.
I was just going to say.
I mean, so does Leah. And so I wonder if, because I do think the personalities in a pitch meeting are just ripe. And so for me, I think I was mapping my own experience onto it in a way that I kind of found it really pleasurable. I also will just cop to the fact that Andrea Martin is my end all be all, and I'll watch her do anything. Like the Marc Maron conversation that she had with is like one I actually regularly go back to. I love her. But I also think there's a sweetness to it, which doesn't exist anymore because Prestige TV has made everything so acidic, which is fine. But it also, you know, there's something, it feels like a little bit like Cool Water. And I have to say, maybe I'm a little too sensitive, but I like seeing a mom who is ridiculous and goofy and, you know, yes, she does all the dumb things that you would, all the, you know, you have to teach her how to use the stuff kind of stuff. But I like that at the end of the day that that relationship is actually a real one. I sort of appreciated that and thought, you know, I'm glad that we're not, it doesn't exclusively make fun of her. And that's partly her doing because of who she is. But she's also, in this other way, like, kind of competent. In the way that, you know, moms are, helicopter moms are. And I find that really, really enjoyable.
She's, it comes from, even from the very first scene of the show, when you realize that they're on the phone all the time, that she and her mom are on the phone all the time. It's not really unwelcome. Like, she chats with her mom all the time on the phone just because they talk on the phone all the time.
And it's very sweet.
The reason why it's chaotic to have her mom come to work is because it's your mom at work. Not because her mom's embarrassing and terrible and she hates her, even though her mom is sometimes embarrassing, just like she's sometimes probably embarrassing to her mom. But it's not because, like, oh, can you imagine moms are so old? Like, it's not just that joke. It's mm-hmm. sometimes that joke, but it's not just that joke. I don't know.
So there's something that 30 Rock did in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt where there's no more laugh track. And instead of laugh track, you have this sort of bright, funny music-y, mm-hmm. like it's a throwback kind of nostalgia. And now I look at, like, watching this gave me the feeling of nostalgia that I might have had watching WKRP or
yeah.
something like that. Like, it's this premature nostalgia.
Yeah, it's the same music,
definitely,
guys, on this and mm-hmm. on 30 Rock and on Kimmy Schmidt, one of whom is Tina Fey's husband. Mm-hmm. And I think you can identify that, like, not a lot of sitcoms have that kind of orchestrated, tinkly mm-hmm. music.
Right,
it was the
right.
first thing about this that made me think, like, oh, it's very similar in style and feel, despite having a different creator. Mm-hmm. It has a house style. If Tina Fey and Robert Carlock are going to have a house style, that's okay with me.
I'm sold.
Mm-hmm. Right. And on a character level, it's working because you can pair off any two characters and there's a scene there. There's mm-hmm. some kind of dynamic yeah. that is unique.
That's, right.
That's what you need. That's
yeah.
vital to a sitcom.
It was surprising to me that I liked it because, gosh, some of these dynamics really are kind of classic. It's the John Michael Higgins character is not that far away from, like, Ted Baxter mm-hmm. and the kind of the arrogant aging
host.
I'm nervous that I'm getting old and I'm
Bill McNeil.
Bill McNeil on News
right,
Radio.
Right.
And yet somehow I still have to, you know?
I actually, it comes under the heading of things I could watch with my kids when they're older.
Yeah.
And there aren't that many things like that that are enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like, I have to move beyond, like, Moana at some point. So thank you very much. Great news.
I dug it. All right. So again, come and find us. Tell us what you think about Great News if you've had a chance to give it a shot. Come and find us on Facebook or on Twitter. Tell us what you think. And when we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and of every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. They source the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed, along with step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take 30 minutes to make. Everything is delivered in a special insulated box with free shipping, and meals are now less than $10 each. Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners can receive $30 off their first week of deliveries. Just visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code HAPPYHOUR30 on your first purchase.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? I'm going to go first to Glenn Weldon. What is making you happy this week, buddy?
Sense8 is back for
oh boy.
Season 2, and it's great. It is just as earnest and gorgeous looking as ever. And I got to say, I was powering through The Handmaid's Tale one episode at a time, yeah. and I had it on my laptop on Hulu, and then on the television screen, there was Netflix just waiting, and I just kept hearing, between every episode, I'd get out of Handmaid's Tale going, oof, boy, oof, and I'd hear, like, watch us, Glenn. Watch Sense8. We are sexy. We are colorful. We are exciting. We're funny. We are queer.
Uh-huh.
Watch us. Don't yeah. watch that thing. Watch
mm-hmm.
us.
Yeah.
This thing is just so gorgeously shot. The cinematography is by John Tull, chiefly. And yes, there's an element of travel porn to it. It's just
right.
all these wonderful locations. But there's an image early on where the character of Will is in silhouette and profile, and the sun is coming from behind him, and we see just the tiny little hairs on his face, on his nose, and his chin, sort of limning him, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He's limbed by the sunlight, and it's just amazing. So many times you just want to stop and look at this thing. But it's also so expertly constructed, because the idea is you've got these eight people who are psychic, linked, and when need arises, they can connect with each other and take advantage of each other's skills. Somebody is a martial artist, somebody is an actor, so they can kind of, you know, get through life by using each other. And so you have a shot of the actor, and then you have the shot of the actor who is, you know, playing the person who is mm-hmm. helping them out, doing the same thing. And it's just cut this amazing way. The logistics of filming this thing,
mm-hmm.
It just, let alone the international angle of it, is just fascinating and fun, and it's Sense8, and it's so good. It's so good, you guys.
Sense8 is back. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
So since we were just talking about sitcoms, if Great News is in the, you know, is the delicious Easter egg package of fizzy,
mm-hmm.
I have found myself sort of wanting both that, but also something a little darker. And I just want to say, I thought I was not going to be able to go back to Veep this season because
yeah.
of because I was on the drama Election 2016
yes.
working on it
yes.
up close and personal. I thought I wasn't going to be able to laugh at something that
right.
at politics. politics again. And I find that not only can I laugh, I can laugh at things that are so painful, such poison-tipped things. I mean, there's so many times I've had to stop because some little quip has gone so deep that it is almost not funny.
Yeah.
So anyway, if I want to recommend it to people who, especially if you like me, thought, I don't want to do any more politics, just do it. It's real good.
So good.
Barry has gone back to Veep. Veep is back. Thank you very much, Barry.
You're Hardiman. Very welcome.
Leah Donnello, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
So there is this really wonderful tradition of people dressing their babies and little kids up as Rihanna.
Oh, nice.
So this week after the Met Gala, someone dressed their like 3-year-old up in a really ornate kind of like gown that looked just like Rihanna's gown. Mm. And that picture has been getting me through the week.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we will provide a link to that picture because baby dressed like Rihanna sounds like something that I would also look at all week. Thank you very much, ma'am. So making me happy this week, another podcast out of the Previously.tv family that I've talked about before that makes Extra Hot great and the Beverly Hills 90210 podcast that I love, which is called Again With This. They now have a podcast called Little House on the Podcast, which is hosted by Kim Reed, who is an old Television Without Pity recapper for a long time. And Kim used to do a thing inside of her recaps where she would just stop talking about whatever show she was recapping. And she would just say, and now it's time for the most awesome thing I saw on TV this week. And very often it would be something very silly. And she got into a habit of doing old Little House on the Prairie episodes where she would describe it in kind of a lot of detail about how, well, you know, that snobby Mary, she's always such a suck up. And so this podcast is literally just Kim giving like a 13-minute monologue describing an episode of Little House on the Prairie. It's extremely funny. Again, it's called Little House on the Podcast. And before we go, we do have one other thing. Speaking of great news, which we were just talking about, you already know that we have a live show in New York on June 6th, but we also are going to do another live show. This one is in LA. And we are heading to, I feel like, one of the basic great houses of Podcastonia.
Exactly.
Am I lying, Glenn?
No. It's Podcast Central.
Where are we going to be?
We're going to be playing the Largo at the Coronet.
The Largo in LA. That is, again, on June 15th. The tickets for that will be on sale Tuesday, May 16th. That's at 12 p.m. Pacific time. 12 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesday, May 16th. Oh, and who's going to be our guest? Oh, you're all going to be very excited. From Code Switch, Shireen Marisol Meraji.
That's so exciting. You guys should go get some tickets. I'm lucky enough to be able to call her on the phone.
Shireen is one of the people we have been really wanting to have on the show for quite a while. We haven't managed to get her on the actual podcast. You know why? Because she's out there in L.A. But she's going to be at our L.A. live show. You've heard her on the Code Switch podcast with Gene Demby. It's going to be super exciting. We could not be more psyched. And again, the tickets for that will be on sale Tuesday, May 16th for the show on June 15th. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman. That's BHARDYMON. You can follow Leah at Ask Liesel. Am I correct about that?
That is correct.
That is AskLeezul. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.